Did that start? Yes. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures. Tonight, episode 131. And we thought we'd talk a little bit about overlanding and traditional camping. So, kind of our thoughts, opinions, some pros, some cons, comparisons, similarities. That's kind of what I'm imagining there, Ben. And I know we only talked about it for a few minutes there, much like we do with a lot of our topics. So you guys get this, you know, fairly live and you get our honest opinions and stuff. But it has been something you've been tinkering with a little bit now, Ben, especially since you've gotten the new Bushcraft vehicle there. And we did an episode on that a little while ago. And if anybody wants to look at that or listen to that, I suggest you go back and pick it up. It's actually a pretty interesting one there where Ben got his new vehicle. But yeah, you've been kind of tinkering with the idea. So why don't you lead us into this a little bit, Ben, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot, and give us some of your thoughts on overlanding versus, well, not even versus, just give us some of your thoughts on overlanding.
Yeah, okay. So to start off, I'm not pro or anti overlanding. It's just another aspect to me that can be encompassed within the bushcraft world. It's an avenue, I guess. And for me, the way I look at it, the way I interpret it, and not everyone may interpret it the exact same way, it's bushcrafting with your primary goal is to use your vehicle to get out there and do the things. And to what degree you rely on that and all that does change, but the vehicle becomes an integral part of the operation. So it does give you some advantages. You can carry more gear. You can go greater distances, but you're also somewhat restricted to roads and trails that are passable by the vehicle you're using. And whether you consider that a restriction or not is a hard thing to really say. But it does open up some avenues, I guess, for a lot of people. So I have been playing with it. Like Robert mentioned, I do have a Subaru Forester that I've nicknamed Scout, and I'll oftentimes refer to it as Scout, and it's, you know, I'm pretty pleased with it. It's doing what I want. I have a few other buddies who do it, and they have Jeeps and they have trucks, and they use different means, and to each his own, right? Like what works for you, you know, is what individually works. So I guess where we should go next, and I'm just trying to figure this out the best in my head, is what are the main advantages and how do you set up your vehicle for it to work? And then we can kind of get into where. Does that work for you, Robert? Did you have a sort of slightly different idea?
Nope, that works perfectly for me. If I'm just going to throw my two cents in on overlanding, and then we can go right into it if that's cool with you, Ben. So, I mean... Between Ben and I, Ben is a little bit more into this than I am. He knows a little bit more about it. He's done the research. He actually told me a little bit about it. I've since done a little research on it myself. And like Ben kind of alluded to there, it's comparing it is kind of like comparing apples and oranges because it's two sides of the same coin, but kind of two heads of the same hydra, if that makes any kind of sense. It can be definitely a part of bushcrafting because you are kind of being reliant on your own skills as you're out there. And a lot of people that do the overlanding and who I've talked to and, you know, just pick their brains a little bit, say the big difference they talk about is it's just as much about the journey, getting there, going through the roads and, you know, getting intimate with their vehicles and learning exactly how they want to tune them and to do this and that. That's just as much a part of it as the actual camping when they get there, if not more so for them, because when they get there, they get to see beautiful scenery. They get to have a nice little rest. They do the camping thing, but it almost, to the people that are really into it, like, don't get me wrong, it becomes a labor of love in getting their vehicle done up the way they want. I don't think there's ever one that's completely finished that I've talked to anyway. Like they're always changing something or making it more customizable to what they want. And that's where the passion comes in. And I think that's great. Like you said, it definitely gives you that relationship with your vehicle and you have to make sure it's going where you want it to. But you can still take some of the best parts of bushcrafting along with you. And I thought that's kind of why this would make an interesting interesting topic for tonight and have a little chat about it. And I'd like to hear from our listeners what they think about, because hopefully there's a couple people out there, maybe, just maybe, somebody's listening to some of our podcasts, this one perhaps in the future, while they're off on an overlanding adventure. You know what I mean? Maybe this is how you pass time, maybe it's not, whatever. But anyway, I'd love to hear from you folks out there about your overlanding experiences, just to kind of inform us a little bit more. We never advocate to being experts on any subject. And I think I can say that with pretty good confidence with as well, Ben, right? So
a point you hit on, and I really want to kind of elaborate a tiny bit on it. Like you said, people aren't never really done. And with me, like, even when I'm not looking at that option, my pack has never really finished being designed. And, you know, I do get other packs. I get different sleeping bags. I get different tarps. I get different stoves. Like, anytime you're into any of these activities, I think it's never really done. And that's the adventure, trying to improve it, to be that little bit better, get you that little bit more. Ultralight guys are always trying to figure out how many grams can I shave off my overall trip. What can I do without? What can I do with? With overlanding, it does center a little bit more around the vehicle. So your individual clothing may not matter as much, but your tires are going to matter. Your ability to manipulate your tires. So tire pressure, dropping your PSI, all that has to do with it. Your suspension, you know, do you have recovery gear, traction boards, winches, come-alongs, you know, all these things, high lift jacks. And we talked about all these on another episode, mm-hmm. but all the stuff, plus then what do you put into your vehicle? You can have fridges, you can have stoves, you can have all the stuff. And guys try to make it so that it's like you park and you're almost instantly set up. You open up the doors, you pull a couple of things out, and boom, you're done, right? And that's where I guess it really matches with a lot of bushcrafting. Like our hammocks, same idea. We've kind of get it down. Like if you get your hammock figured out, it's like you show up, you hook it onto a tree, slide it over, put it on another tree, you cut even down a couple of ropes, and boom, it's set up. Like how quick do you want to be able to hook your hammock up? Like it's always a goal, how quick you can get it up and be set up. So getting to the destination and enjoying it to your max potential, and then setting up quickly so you can enjoy camp. Those are the things I think it kind of, you know, really meshes with.
And I love, or the part of it that interests me, I should say, there's a creativity side to it, or creative side to it. Especially if you find those people that kind of make their own overlanding vehicles. And what I'm thinking off here is, because it's something that I tinkered with in the past, but never to this extreme, was I had a cap on my truck, and I kind of made it for sleeping in the back off, especially with my previous work. It was nice just to be able to, you know, crawl in back and go to sleep. But I've seen them where people have set up benches, and they've made it almost like a camper on back of their truck, even with little wood stoves and stuff in it, where they literally just drive, and they'll stop, and they'll make the back face over a lake or a mountain or something that's really nice view, and that's where they stop for the night. Put a little fire on, cook some stove, they lay in their bed, look out the back window, and it's just amazing. But like I said, it kind of comes back to, or at least in their opinion, comes back to the journey is just as much fun as the being there, as where sometimes with camping, the journey sometimes gets overlooked a little bit. You're always like, you find the spot in the map, that's where you want to be. Sometimes you put your head down, you start trudging. Or as Melissa and I used to call it, we death march. You just kind of get into a zone. Well, it's true. You get into a zone, your eyes kind of glass over it, and you beeline. You know what I mean? You're paying attention so you don't slip and break an ankle or sprain anything like that. But you kind of put the old blinders on. Your tunnel vision comes in, and you're just on autopilot until you get to where you're going. And we talked about this in previous episodes, where you kind of got to take a step back and hopefully get out of that cycle. But truthfully, that does happen sometimes when you're, you know, going through the woods, because it starts to close in on you a little bit, but not in a bad way. Just in it all starts to kind of look the same. If you're walking through a black spruce forest, after about an hour off it, you've seen the black spruce trees and you've seen, you know, the wet ground. That's basically what you're in for as you go. And you just kind of snap the switch. It turns off and you get into that death march eye glossing. As we're with the overlanders, you do have the advantage, I think, at least in my opinion, the advantage off your driving. You're a little bit more relaxed. You're generally going slow down some of these roads. Like once you hit the highways and stuff, obviously you're out there and you're blazing her, but down these back roads, you're taking your time. and you get to enjoy some of the scenery. You get to have, you know, that kind of bit of challenge and fun with going over rough terrain and stuff like that. You learn some new terms for your vehicles, like your breakover angle, your departure angle. Like, you start learning these terms and what they mean and how they're going to affect you as you're going through the woods. I'd never really thought about it a lot with my truck until you and I started having the discussion, and then I started taking measurements and watching videos and figuring out what I could and couldn't do. And that's all kind of fun of it too.
Oh yeah. And when you kind of get into some of that stuff, you realize like your breakover is really dependent on the overall length of your vehicle and your overall height. So if you got a short vehicle, it can afford to be lower height and still get over what a long vehicle can't.
And a prime example of that, not taking it from cars this instance, but I think I've talked to you about this before. I have a four-wheeler. My in-laws have a side-by-side. They're literally the same bike in two different formats. I got a Foreman 500. They have the Pioneer 500. You know, yeah. 500 chassis, all of that. The bikes are super similar, except theirs is a couple inches longer, and I can't remember how much it was, but we did measure it out. And quite often when we're going around places, I'll go over stuff, have no problem, and they'll hit and get hung up, and I have to give them either a rock or a tug over the obstacle. And yeah, when they bought it, I mean, it was never a thought. I never thought about it. I go all these places on the four-wheeler, and I'm like, well, my bike makes it there fine. But now translating that into real-world overlanding, if your buddy says, well, my vehicle goes there fine, they might both be Subarus. They might both be... I'll go with my own. You might have a Ford Ranger and a Toyota Tacoma. Very similar trucks and look and style and stance and stuff like that. I mean, I can hear the eyes rolling in back of some people's heads. I'd never own a Ford or I'd never own a Toyota. Irregardless of what you think personally of those companies, the trucks are very similar. But that's not to say that the departure angle, the breakover angle, all that's still the same. So you really have to learn what your vehicle is. And when somebody says, oh yeah, my truck can make it through there, well, then you got to start comparing your vehicle in relation to theirs. Well, if they made it through with a breakover angle of so much and a departure angle of so much and mine's a little less, does that mean now you start asking the questions, well, is there anywhere where, you know, maybe your skid plates rub a little bit, or did your bumper touch? Because if it just touches for them and you got significantly less departure angle, you might pull the damn thing off on yours. You know what I mean? All things I never thought about when it came to overlanding.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I agree 100%. And I mean, this is why no one vehicle is perfect. So someone could say, oh, well, you know, the Jeep Gladiator to me is the absolute best vehicle. But the Jeep Gladiator, yes, you can put some pretty big tires on it. It has great approach, departure, and breakover. But it's also wide as hell. So the same trail that I could potentially drive down without touching a thing in my little Subaru, he may never make it. He may never make it between those, you know, those two trees. He may have to take a different route. On the flip side, we get partway down the trail and something that he passes over with ease, I might never be able to clear, or I may never be able to climb. I just don't have that in me. And then it comes down to just skill of operating your vehicle, because breakover can be greatly fixed by just angling your attack. So mm-hmm. instead of coming at it straight on, come at it with a slight angle. Like if you go over an object at 45 degree angle, almost always one tire is on top. You're going to clear it. One tire might eventually come off the ground, but that's not a problem if you have a decent traction system and your vehicle can handle it. And all this adds up. You know, I'm proud and happy of the one I have, and somebody else might look at it and say, well, that's shit, Ben. Like, why did you buy that? It's useless. But I've taken it already in this summer in multiple places that I would challenge most people to take their vehicles, and I've been very pleased with it, and that's all that matters to me, is I'm pleased with it. It's gotten me where I wanted to go. It's gotten me places I didn't expect that I would be able to get in a street vehicle. I sent you some pictures, and we don't necessarily have to share them, but I drove down some roads on Monday night. There was enough grass and alders growing up in the middle of the road that I would hazard to guess nothing else had drove down that road this year.
No, and that's the thing. This is where it all comes back to. It adds another element into stuff that adds your signature onto it. You know what I mean? Your Subaru is your Subaru. You know how it works. You know what it's capable of with you behind the wheel. Now, is that the same as it is if I got behind the wheel of it? I can guarantee you not. I might be able to do some things better. I might be able to do a lot of things worse. You know what I mean? It's, there is kind of a knack to it. There's skill involved, of course, but there's also a passion. And I think that's really what overlanding is about in relation to camping and bushcrafting and stuff like that. You have to have some passion to back that up, because it's not a cheap hobby to get into. First of all, you got to have a vehicle. That you're willing to become your overlanding vehicle. Now, that could be your daily driver. That's fine. But you have to be, you have to have that mindset of like, okay, I potentially could be taking this down some dicey roads, some bad trails. I mean, does it have skid plates? Am I going to mind if the bumper gets a little scratched up? Is there, you know, there's always that chance that even if you got skid plates, well, what happens if you, you know, nail the oil pan and you decide to leave a nice little love tap on that? Like, there's things that could potentially happen that you have to be okay with before you ever even attempt overlanding. Is that safe to say, Ben? Like I said, that's kind of how I feel about it.
You definitely have to be aware that it's a risk, and it's a risk that you, you know, you could really have. And I mean, it, you don't have to go off the main road very far to lose all cell coverage. In fact, here in Nova Scotia, there's quite a few highways you lose coverage on the highway. So if you're getting off the highway and now driving away from people, the likelihood that you have good cell signal actually goes down pretty good. So me and my daughter went Monday night, and we went about 45 minutes to an hour off the road. And I mean, that sounds like we went a great distance, but the reality is some of these roads were very bad and we were probably only moving 15, 20 kilometers an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, I was able to use X mode, which doesn't run at that high of a speed, for quite a bit of it. And I mean, I had a lot of fun. I never hit anything, but I did have in the back of my head, I mean, some of these rocks look pretty bad. Like, what if one of them got rips my tire off? Now I'm down to like putting a spare on and miserable. I mean, it was Monday night. It was raining hard. Mm-hmm. So it was miserable out there. It would not have been a fun time. And I don't have the tires I want on it yet. I don't have various things that I want to put on this vehicle. So it's not perfectly set up. In fact, 80% of the time I've had this vehicle, I had bigger, more rugged tires on it. And the two times I've really got to test it is when I was in Newfoundland for over 10 days. And this last weekend, I was running street tires on it.
Which, but knowing that going in, you accepted those risks. You know what I mean? So,
no, I definitely accepted those risks.
But yeah, and that's kind of the beauty of it. You know what I mean? It's, I don't know. Like I said, it's a very, I could see it being a very satisfying, and I don't want to say hobby, interest is the best thing I can put into it, because some of these people that go out overlanding and stuff like that, like, they're gone for days. That's pretty similar to camping. Some of them go for weeks. All right, you're hitting the high end. Then there's people that go for months, and there's some that go for like over a year or more. They're just, they decide to throw everything they have in a vehicle and they're just going to go touring. They're going to go beating down these back roads and stuff like that. And through trails that, you know, most of us probably didn't want to take our four-wheeler, but they're bombing down it in their vehicle, and they're going exploring. They're going to find themselves. I hear that term a lot. They're going to find themselves or find something bigger than themselves. Whatever way you want to say it, they're committing to this. So I believe there's a big level of commitment with this as well, that you might have a little bit of a safety net between the bushcrafting and the camping aspect of it. You're not getting... Don't get me wrong, you can spend some serious money in bushcrafting and camping, like, whichever way you want. And there is a little bit of a difference between bushcrafting and camping. You know how, like, all toads are frogs, but not all frogs are toads? And you can check that fact, it's true. all camping is potentially bushcrafting, but not all bushcrafting is technically camping. Anyway, the analogy I'm trying to make there is you can spend some serious money on whichever interest you have there. But once it comes to overlanding and you really want to get into it, you're going to drop some serious coin, or you're going to have some pretty good friends that are going to bail you out of the woods or run you spare parts. Because if I decided I want to go overlanding and I'm going to go all the way to Arizona, and I decide my engine blows out in Arizona, like, what do I do there? I have to have a contingency plan. Do I get a backup vehicle? Am I going to fly out? Am I going to tow the vehicle? Am I going to burn it on the side of the road and collect the insurance? Like, you know, there's got to be a plan there. But you kind of have a little bit of freedom when it comes to camping and bushcrafting that generally, and I do say generally, not painting a full brush here, but you're not going as far away. The risks to yourself are just as great, but the risks to your gear and stuff, generally not as great, because you go out, there's a windstorm, it destroys your tent. Well, your night was shot. You know what I mean? You get back in your vehicle, you go home, you had a bad trip. Once again, you get to Arizona, you blow the engine, you live in Nova Scotia, now you got to figure out the whole way of getting back. It's not as simple as just throwing the tent in the garbage and going back home. It's, well, now you have an entire vehicle full of gear, plus the vehicle, plus yourself, thousands of miles away that you got to try and figure out and juggle.
Yeah. But sort of like, this is not a risk that you wouldn't take anytime you take your vehicle out. Like, the argument is, and I'll use an example, a family member of mine was traveling across the country a few years ago, and underway through, they broke down. So they had to stop, and they got repaired, and then they had numerous problems with their vehicle. And nothing wrong with their vehicle, it just was shit luck, like it broke down a few times. And traveling clean across the country, like Canada's a big country, no doubt about it. At some point, they decided it would be better off to trade that vehicle in and get something newer, more reliable. So a vehicle they loved and truly loved, they traded it for a different vehicle because they knew it was going to get them home safe and sound. I've traveled to Newfoundland and had to get, you know, wheel bearings replaced on the road. Like, that's annoying and not useful. But it is what it is. And when it happens, it happens. But you're right. Like, you could completely write your vehicle off, at which point, you know, one of your options is to buy a full replacement. And Kijiji or Craigslist or Facebook is full of cheap vehicles.
Oh, no, I'm not, for sure. And I mean, there's always that option of just, as the vehicle breaks down, like you said, you just pick up a new one and keep going. I got a friend. He's done it on several occasions. That's basically what him and his now wife, at the time girlfriend, they went to places like, I'm trying to think, they went to Mexico for sure, they went to Vietnam, a few other places. They literally, like, bought a van here, lived in that van, drove all the way to Mexico, stayed in Mexico for a couple months living in this van, sold the van down there for enough airfare to fly home. They went to Vietnam, same thing, they flew over, bought a motorcycle while they were there. Their entire trip was based around this motorcycle, sold the motorcycle to come home. Like, they've done this several times and had great luck with it. Me? I don't think I have the knack for it. I imagine I would get over there, I'd buy a bike, and then, you know, that bike would, nobody would ever want it again. But people do this and they have great luck. They have blind luck. But, I mean, if you want to do it that way, you gotta do a little pre-research, figure out how you're going to do this. Have other people done it? I mean, it's not something I don't think you can just jump into blindly and run with, though some people do. Some people do. But I think there should be a little precognitive thinking involved in that.
But vehicles are basically a relatively easy thing to buy and sell if you're not too greedy. So if you think about it, if you have a set amount that you're willing to lose. So take motorcycles, for instance. I mean, it's a little bit off topic, but I think it works. You go on Facebook right now, you can pick up a motorcycle similar to mine for around $2,000 all day long. $2,000 to $3,000, no problem. If you think about it, how many people easily spend $2,000 to $3,000 going down south for a week?
Easy.
Right? Easy. Not a hard thing to do. So if you decide that your trip is going to be this vehicle, you buy this vehicle, and then you drive it around for a week or two, or however long you plan on spending down there. You go everywhere you want to do, see everything you want to do. When you come back, you sell it for whatever you can sell it for. So you've already said, I'm willing to lose $3,000 on this. Like, I don't care if I sell it. And you come back, you sell it for $2,000, you lost $1,000. Oh, well, still, you know, in $2,000 more than you expected. But I've heard stories of guys making profit on it. A buddy of mine, he had friends, flew down to Australia. He loved telling the story. They flew down to Australia. They bought two motorcycles, drove them around Australia all summer long. And apparently, he said they sold them for like $300-$400 profit. at the end of the trip, they have more money in their pocket than they started.
And I mean, that's what I mean. Some people have a knack and some blind luck, and it goes really well for them. I'm just not saying it would go so well for me, but it's something to think about. If you like that nomad lifestyle, and I mean, I use that term lightly, but you know, that kind of wanderer or wanderlust lifestyle where you literally just go by the seat of your pants, you can incorporate that into overlanding. And overlanding is not restricted to, at least by definition, it's not restricted to cars and trucks and things like that. You can have a motorcycle as an overlanding vehicle. A buddy of mine, I'll call him Norm, he's a helicopter pilot now, but he had a KLR 650. And I mean, yeah, he went everywhere with that thing, and he just took a small tent, a sleeping pad, and a sleeping bag. And I mean, he had pictures all over his social media from him going to places that haven't been visited in ages. Like, we have an abandoned town here in Nova Scotia, and that's not too far off from where you're at there, actually, Ben. Anyway, a completely abandoned town that still has structures and stuff like that, but you can't get to it by normal means. You generally have to take a bike or walk in. He drove right into that, and he stayed in there for a couple days. Different mines and stuff like that, same kind of thing. Like, places that most people don't visit just because of how hard they are to access. He was having a great time with. He would take his KLR in, his little tent, a small cook set, you know, some basic camping supplies, as he called it. Not even bushcrafting. He called them basic camping supplies. And he would go and stay at locations for, you know, 2, 3, 4 days, whatever floated his boat. And then he'd just pack up and go. Maybe he'd stop at a location, plan to stay there for 3 days. Didn't like the location, you know, bugs, whatever. Maybe there wasn't something he was expecting. He'd just move on. And that's kind of the beauty off the whole overlanding thing. And you can, once again, once you, you know, you pick your vehicle and stuff like that, if you pick a truck or something, well, now you're limited to roads where that truck will fit. If it's a motorcycle, yes, you take a little less gear, but now you get a little bit more travel. You know what I mean? Like, he never went anywhere fast. He just took his time, pegged through. And I think he since sold the bike. Don't get me wrong. I haven't talked to him in a few years. He moved up to Newfoundland. But I still think now he flies locations. He has the cheating aspect of if he's running a job, he can stop and spend a few days here and there while the job, there's holdovers and stuff like that. So he may be like flying. I'm trying to think. He said he was flying somebody north and there was a 3 or 4 day holdover. So he stopped on I think he said he landed on an iceberg or something like that and stayed a night on that. Like, just a super cool story, and sent me some pictures, and it was kind of neat. Now, a helicopter is an extreme case of overlanding, I think, because that is literally over and landing. But, I mean, it's kind of your imagination. It's your only limit there. So I've heard people do it on bicycles and motorcycles and cars and trucks and vans and cube vans and, like, you're literally only limited by what you allow yourself to be limited by.
Yeah, well, I think your only real limitation with overlanding is you're limited by what your vehicle can do. And in that in multiple ways. And one is, what can your vehicle carry? I mean, you can strap stuff to the roof. You can put stuff in a hitch. You can stuff inside the vehicle. You can sleep in the vehicle. You can take a tent. You can take a hammock. You can string the hammock from the vehicle to a tree. Two trees, you have all these options. Some people try to stay as self-contained as they can so that basically they don't have to depend on an outside resource, and that's great. Other people with the smaller vehicles, like honestly with my Forester, I'm 6 foot tall, I would have trouble stretching down with the seat folded down, and it's not perfectly flat, but I could do it. I don't mind sleeping with my legs slightly bent, but you know, it's doable. Is it perfect? No. But I have my hammocks. I have my tents. I have all my other bushcrafting gear. And it's designed to be small and lightweight and easy to carry, so I can stick all that in. It allows me to throw a couple of boats on top. That's awesome. You know, when we go hiking, I can't carry a boat very easily, right?
No, and that's the thing. Your vehicle does give you additional carry space. You know what I mean?
Refrigerator. This is a great one. You can take a little 12 volt, and I mean, I picked one up. I got one for free a few years ago. A little 12 volt refrigerator, and now you don't have to worry about your food going bad as much. Like, so you can carry more food, go longer. You can have better meals than you might otherwise have had.
I mean, me and you have always talked, on the first day you can have the best meal in the world. Second day,
your options start dwindling.
Yeah. At third and fourth day, you're down to freeze-dried food. I mean, you're not, but you are, right?
Well, kind of. I mean, you're either willing to eat jerky or some sort of preserved meat. Because over that time, like 5 days, you take a steak and throw it on your counter and tell me what it's like 5 days later. You know what I mean? Without preserving it in some method, that's kind of what you're dealing with while you're camping. Even if you got coolers and stuff like that, that's added weight and crap. But like you said, 12-volt fridge or even one of those little 12-volt coolers that just keep stuff relatively cool, that's still extending life. And you have a vehicle to carry it, plus the power to power it. It's kind of a no-brainer. It does add a nicety into there.
And then, I mean, you can potentially have solar panels that extends your batteries and stuff. So it all adds up. I mean, the really popular one now is the Jackery. I've never used one, but I understand the concept. It's an inverter with a power supply, charges off your car when you drive, and then you can run your accessories without risking the battery and the system on your vehicle while it's sitting idle. And people say they can go a whole weekend on a Jackery. Like the bigger Jackery can go a whole weekend running those little coolatrons or 12-volt fridges. You can also run all your lighting and stuff like that. And of course, guys do a lot to extend that. So they replace all their lights with LEDs. They do everything they can to lower their power signature so they can run things longer and better. But there is a lot. Like, there is a ton of awesome trails here in Nova Scotia. There's a ton in Newfoundland. And I know, and I've seen some of them, there's a ton in New Brunswick. So here in, you know, Atlantic Canada, we have, if you're willing to look, you're willing to find, there's a ton of great spots that you can get to that the average person, the average Nova Scotian, is never going to see.
No, just do a Google search for Overlanding Nova Scotia. Tons of places to find. So I'm going to try and bring us back around here a little bit. We talked about a lot of the comparison similarities and stuff like that, but something you said back to the start, and let's circle to that, is there's certain things you can do to get your vehicle ready for overlanding. And seeing this is kind of the part that you are, I don't want to say you're into now, but that you're kind of into, this is the part that never really ends. So what's some basic concepts that maybe people are interested from your experience might be good ideas to start, you know, formulating in your head that you might want to do with your vehicle to get into the overlanding scene?
I think the very first thing is that, I mean, the best vehicle is the vehicle you have. The best camera is the camera you have. You know what I mean? Like, but start with it and just look at it and make sure that it's reliable. So do your basics maintenance, you know, change your oils, change your fluids, check them all over. From there, get the support tools and equipment you need. So if you are going to go off-road, you know, the ability to air down your tires in a bad situation may mean the difference between you getting out from being stuck and you being stuck with, you know, needing a tow truck. All of a sudden, that $120 pump and $15 for an air down kit seems like a pretty good deal when you just paid $500 to get towed out of, you know, a pretty remote location, right? And even where I was to Monday, I'm not sure how well the average, you know, tow truck would have done. Because they're not necessarily all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive vehicles. Like, they're bigger trucks that can pull a lot of stuff, and sometimes they get dually tires. Well, I was down some pretty narrow and awkward trails.
Not to mention the additional weight on these tow trucks. Sometimes they may get stuck where you didn't have so much of a hard time to go through because of the lightness of your vehicle.
Yeah. So having the ability to get out is, you know, on your own, because that's first and foremost, you need to be able to depend on yourself. So it's a basic kit. A lot of the stuff is not super expensive. It's just getting it and getting the stuff that you're happy with, because the everyday go to Canadian Tire and buy just a basic pump, 12-volt pump, some of them won't even survive pumping up one or two tires. Like, they will not. They will overheat. They'll blow circuits. They just won't do it. They'll top up a low-pressure tire time and time again. But if you got to fill up a tire, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Uh, So you may want to actually invest in a decent one of those. I have two full sets of traction boards with me when I go. That's a huge comfort, knowing that if I'm stuck down in some pretty soft mud, sand, whatever, I have something hard that I can stick underneath the tires and get half a chance at pulling myself, you know, just drive myself out. I don't have a winch yet. Someday I think that would be something I'd like to consider. Do you have to lift your vehicle? That's a personal decision, but a good set of tires, absolute must, I think, is having a reliable set of tires.
And getting to the lifting the vehicle thing, I see a lot of people, they'll jack their vehicles up for no other reason than, you know, they want a jacked up vehicle. And they'll put 4-inch lift in and run the stock tires. You know what I mean? Like, why? Why? The whole idea in lifting a vehicle is to get the clearance to put on larger tires, which in turn gives you more clearance from the parts that's going to hit the ground. So by lifting your vehicle, generally lifting, especially with trucks, you're putting spacers between the frame and the body of the truck. That gives you the lift. You know, generally there's more to it than that, of course. But if you keep the stock tires, your rear ends are still sitting basically the same height off the ground, even though the body might be higher. You have a technically gained marginal clearance.
So you would have most likely gained some approach and departure angle and even some breakover angle with that. But where you are going to be stuck, and this is the downfall to almost every truck, and when I started looking into a lot of stuff, this is one of the things I started doing. I started looking at the ass end of vehicles. And if you're driving down the highway, you start looking at the ass end of almost every vehicle out there. And most of them, you can see the rear differential. And it's, you know, a buddy of mine calls them the pumpkin. It's a huge arse thing. And it's usually the lowest thing on your truck. And it's the thing that's going to hit. And if you break it, you're really stuck. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of the weak point of a vehicle. And that's a concerning thought to me. If you look at, say, a lot of all-wheel drive vehicles, there's no centered differential. It's up. They're more clean and flat across underneath. So that's why, even though they may not look any higher, they technically would have slightly better clearance than maybe a different vehicle. But all said and done, each vehicle definitely has its advantages. Just take a look at it.
I mean, the prime example of that is my vehicle and your vehicle. Yours is Subaru Forester?
Yeah.
I have one of the newer Ford Rangers. To put them side by side, my truck towers over your Forester. Clearance? Yeah. I think we figured out you actually have a half inch more, because my clearance is measured from the differential to the ground. Yours is measured from somewhere in the center of the body down, and like you just... It's very similar in clearance for a vehicle that is like literally... If I'm sitting in my truck, I gotta look down at Ben sitting in his car. But the clearance is basically the same.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so at stock, I think it's 8.7. And then when I had the bigger tires on it, I basically figured out that I went from a 27-inch tire, that's, you know, full diameter tire, to I was running a 29-inch tire, a 27.5 to a 29-inch. So that's an inch and a half more, so that basically, if you think about it, it gives me 3/4 inch additional clearance. So that's 0.75 on top of my 8.7. So that basically gives me 9.4 inches, 9.45 or whatever, right? It's not a ton, but it's that ballpark. So decent clearance does give you a little add, but each, you know, as you go up tires, you're only getting half the override diameter is of an increase. So you're not getting a ton. When think about it, when you put those bigger tires on, you do lose a few things. You lose mileage. You're going to spend more on fuel. And the other thing you lose is torque. You're not going to get the same torque to the ground with a bigger tire. Your vehicle's working harder to turn that bigger tire. But you're also able to drive over something slightly bigger. So it has its trade-offs. Generally, I'm of the belief that, you know, the manufacturer chose a pretty good tire for the setup they have. And they have a reason for it. Is there an interesting comment there?
No, I was actually trying to figure out what the stock clearance was on my truck. I just looked it up really quick because I do know I increased my suspension a little bit. And I've never really done any conversation about my new Ranger, but if anybody's interested for whatever reason out there, it's just a 2019 Ford Ranger with the FX4 kit on it with slightly tuned suspension and larger tires. So, I mean, nothing ridiculous. You can buy it off the Ford website, basically the way I've got mine done up. And I know I'm a little bit more than stock clearance, but not by much. Like you, maybe 3/4 of an inch, something like that, because of the difference in suspension and a little bigger tire. I think they come stock with 16s or 17s, and I'm running 18s. So, what color? For Ben's car or my truck? My truck's black, Ben's car is blue.
Dark blue.
Dark.
It's pretty good. It's almost the black. And mine has a bunch of silver decals on it. If you ever see it on the highway, it's going to stand out. And it has Atlantic Bushcraft right across the back.
Mine also has Atlantic Bushcraft on the tailgate. So, I mean, you'll tell, Ben and I. I think there's a handful of decals out now, believe it or not. We've sold a couple. We've handed a few out. I mean, there might be a few running around, but they're pretty close friends and acquaintances that have picked them up mostly. So if you see an Atlantic Bushcraft decal, especially Ben's, because Ben's wife, small business Missy G Makes, might as well give her a shout out. She has made basically all our merchandise up to this point. The shirts, Missy G Makes, our decals, Missy G Makes, everything that's on Ben's car, Missy G Makes. If you need something like that, go to Facebook and check out Missy G Makes. She does some great work there, and she has some examples of other stuff. Definitely check it out.
Yeah,
See.
she'd appreciate the sale for sure, and I would appreciate the fact that in a small way you're starting to pay off some of her crafting, which is definitely a losing venture on her part. So is Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures. It's not for a profit, or it's never made a profit.
No, we have sold a few things, and if you put that to a cost versus what is it? Income versus outgoing, I think we are in the deficit of somewhere
Don't want to
hundreds, thousands. It's hard to say at this point.
Where do you even draw the line, right? Like,
Well, that's
where
it.
is.
I don't know what's actually Atlantic Bushcraft anymore and what's personal. So it's arguable that all my bushcrafting stuff I could technically say is Atlantic Bushcraft. Anyway, different
Then we're
rabbit
in
hole.
thousands, buddy. We're in thousands.
Thousands. But yeah, anyway, different rabbit hole. But yeah, what were we talking about, Ben?
We just
Overlanding
talked about
vehicle.
how to
Yeah.
set your vehicle up. And I think the, you know, bare bones, basic, put a good set of tires on it, checking your fluids and stuff. Make sure you have like a reliable, reasonable vehicle. It doesn't have to be new, doesn't have to be great. Throw a sleeping bag in the back. That's, you know, and you're more or less set. You can go, you know, takes. Take a small stove and some food, and you're technically overlanding. You're not king of the road overlanding, but you know you can do it in a Toyota Corolla. I mean, I've seen people go in places with a Toyota Corolla that I've seen trucks not go. Like, not that they couldn't, but they just wouldn't. So like you can get a lot of places with a pretty basic front wheel drive vehicle. Everything you do after that just increases your capabilities. Like you said,
No,
you
I
can
was
do it
going
with
to
a
say,
motorcycle.
funny enough, you remember the waterfall you and I went? The person that showed me where that was took me in a Honda Accord. I tried to take my Ranger at the time in after them. He was living in there. He stayed his whole summer. He was kind of overlanding. He traveled there. That's where he was staying for the summer. He was just touring the area. I tried to take him back in because he was always hitchhiking on the road. That's how I met this guy. Anyway, long story. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll drive you back. And if your Honda made it in there, my Ranger surely can. Rip the gas tank off it. So.
Oh man, I have been in the backwoods and I have seen vehicles and I've sat there and shook my head and said, "How?" That is a serious question went through my head. How did that vehicle possibly get to this location? Because I'd passed stuff already that I was like, you know, we because I've had good, you know, I've had Silverado 4x4 pickups. I've had the Colorado. It was rear locking, rear differential, and I've rarely gotten it stuck or in bad spots. But I've seen spots where, you know, they work to get in and out of stuff. And then I'm driving along, and you see like an Impala.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell? Like,
yeah.
So I'm not dissing any vehicle. Trust me. Like, if you know how to drive it and you're willing to try, you can get some pretty amazing spots.
And that's the thing. Understand your vehicle.
But yeah, you know, the basics is similar to any bushcrafting, in my opinion. Like, you know, get some basic gear that keeps you comfortable and allows you to sleep at your vehicle or near your vehicle. And the beauty of it, I think, with anything along bushcraft, and I think bushcraft encompasses overlanding, where overlanding can't encompass bushcrafting. It's only a small portion, but you can use a ton of your bushcraft in overlanding, and it can pretty well encompass everything, all aspects of it. The beauty of all this stuff is getting out there and exploring and seeing new things. And if you look at it from that point of view, what's a vehicle do? It allows you to travel great distances in a short period of time. It allows you to go to northern Ontario, to northern Quebec, to backwoods Newfoundland, to down into the States, and you know, anywhere else that you can pretty well look at a map. And if you can drive there, you can overland it. Like, that's the beauty of it. You can be self-contained, and the only thing you'll have to stop for is some groceries and the odd, you know, and gas. If you've done it right, you don't need to buy much else.
No, and like I said, that's kind of how it's similar to the bushcrafting camping thing. You can start with very minimal, and the sky's the limit after that. You know what I mean? And Roundabout Media over in the comments is saying a friend of his took his Volvo sedan out in the woods on a trek one night with them, and then it's the car more or less survived. So I imagine there's a story there. And I love hearing these stories of people that take their vehicles out, like... once again, same kind of deal. I've always been big on Rangers, and it's not because I'm a Ford loyalist or anything like that. And I've joked about it with Ben. It's not because I love the vehicles. It's because I can afford the vehicles. I always kind of need a truck with my work. Now, not so much. I've always needed kind of a truck with my work. And honestly, a Ranger was a good entry-level cheap truck to run. It's $100 to fix anything. You need, you know, an alternator, $100. You need a tire, $100. You need a wheel nut, $100. That's the downside, but it's always $100, it seems like, with a Ranger, and that's the only reason I kept going with them. So when I say a Ranger, keep in mind that I've had like 14 of these things in the last 15 years. So because, well, no, see, a slight backstory. When I worked with Natural Resources, I traveled a long distance, and with, once again, my job with them took me down a lot of woods roads, back roads, fire tower roads, stuff like that. There's no point in buying a good vehicle because I was going to beat it apart. I knew I was. And there's no sense in getting a new vehicle because of the distance I was putting on. You know, those 100,000 or 5-year warranties. Well, Ford doesn't even have that. It's a 60,000 or 3-year warranty. I'd blow that out over the first summer. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of traveling I was doing. So there was no point in doing, like, getting a decent vehicle. I literally bought the first thing that I could slap $1,500 on and figured it'd get me through the summer. When I was buying these vehicles, I was assuming by the time winter rolled around that I was selling them as scrap. You know what I mean? If I wasn't, bonus. But I expected that's when it was going to die. And yeah, I have the 5.5-foot box on the, actually, I don't even think it's a 5.5-foot box. I think it's technically like 5'3" or 5'4" or something like that. It's not long. That's one of the downfalls of this Ranger. I had to trade off the crew cab for some box length because I did want to take Melissa and Lily with me and stuff like that. I needed the back seat to accommodate the child seat at the time, and that was the only way to do it. So I sacrificed some of the bed. The way Ford justifies that, and I do say justifies with quotations because I don't think it's a true justification, is they made the box deeper so that when you put the tailgate down, now you technically have a 7-foot box. You're supposed to get one of those bed extenders and stuff like that, but that's adding accessories and yada, yada, yada. So I'm not big on adding accessories so much as using it as is. But I'm trying to figure out now if I can sleep on an angle in that box and be able to put a small cap on it. Because I'm not tall.
What a lot of people have been doing, and if you see Jeremy Lone Wolf 902, I think he had something but putting a tent on a box.
And they do make a tent. So, Mel and I looked at one for ours, and literally, it's the tent sits in the box, tailgate's down. That's where you get your 7 feet. And then it has an awning and stuff on it, too, and they're only like $300. And if I can find that going on sale and I have the money in pocket, I will own one.
All that being said, I mean, there's plenty of ways to do it. You can buy a standard tent, a couple of pieces of wood that are hinged at the middle so that it folds out or locks together, and you can extend it past your bed on either side, mm-hmm. and then put a couple of pieces of plywood that fit inside. Four pieces would make a box. I mean, there's ways to do it. Me personally, this is just me too, like, because you can get the rooftop tents for my forester. I don't want, when I set up camp, to make my vehicle immobile.
No, and we've talked about this in the past too, but rooftop tents and my disliking for them because I'm heavy and I don't want to end up through them. But we've talked about this as well in the past, that once, if you make your vehicle immobilized, what happens if something comes up?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the short box, and I want to just say something. Like, I used to look at trucks with really short boxes. I think it's stupid. And it was because I thought, used to think, what if I want to get a motorcycle back to? What if I want to go pick up some sheets of plywood? What if I want to get some 2x4? You know, average lumber is 8 foot long. Mm-hmm. But there was a guy at work, I seen it about a year ago, I assume it's still there, but he had a regular cab short box truck. And you don't see those very often.
No, because that would basically be a car.
It looks I really liked it because I think it was slightly jacked up. It had slightly bigger tires on it. And I'm thinking that thing probably has some of the best approach, departure, and breakover angles of any vehicle on the road because it has nice sized tires with a short overall length. And I all of a sudden, I kind of seen the purpose of them because for years, like I said, all I could see was the disadvantage of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Oh, they're definitely not something to write off. And you were saying about having the bike and stuff like that. In my truck, it does fit my ZZR 1200. That's a longer motorcycle. Tailgate has to be down, of course. I can put my four-wheeler in it. I have to remove the toolbox off the front, and I have to put a little pad in so the bike kind of sits on a slight angle. Otherwise, the winch goes through the rear window, wearing this the hard way with my old Ranger. But anyway, if I put a slight box on the front of it, it will hold the ATV as well. Once again, some of the weight's sitting on the tailgate. And this is where some of the debate's going to come in, and I can once again feel the ridicule. But contacting Ford, they said they designed that tailgate to hold 1,000 pounds all day long. That's why they sell the box extender. That's why it goes out on the tailgate. I had questions about this. That's how they designed it. That's what they're telling me. So yeah. I am putting that to the test with their... I'm putting my faith in them. But in the back of my mind, I'm waiting for the one bump where the whole ass end comes off the truck and everything comes out. But if it happens, I will report back. But up until this point, I haven't had a problem.
So I did something similar with my Colorado. So my Colorado was a 6 foot box. I had the extended cab, 6 foot box on it. And it had the tailgate that could drop 45 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found I was able to do was get some of my motorcycles in there with the 6 foot box, the front wheels pushed right hard against the front of the box. I could usually just tilt the tailgate up a bit to the 45 and lock it in place. And eventually my straps did break. I'm not going to lie. They did break, and I blamed it completely on Chef. Didn't break under load, but just they did get some corrosion in there. One day I was looking at it, and I said, it doesn't look good, and it snapped right off my hand. So I got mad at Chev, and I went down. I had a chat with Chev, and I said, looked at it, and I said, like, look, they broke. It's still under warranty. They broke. They're like, well, it's your fault. And I said, well, I think it's your fault. Like, you didn't build them right. The little plastic on them kind of broke. Water got in, and the cable corroded. So we argued over it for a few weeks, and then I found out that I could buy them significantly cheaper from JD something in the States. Mm. And I showed them that, and they said, okay, fine, Mr. Greening. He said, you come in next week. We'll have a set of cables for you here. I said, perfect. So I drove in the next week, expecting to get them for the same price as they were in the States. And they gave them to me for free. So I got to say, they did. But it was kind of like, we don't want to talk to you. Take these and go away. Like,
they were silencing you, Ben, is what they were doing, bud. You were silenced. I mean, you still ended up with what you wanted. Don't get me wrong. But you were the go away.
Well, you say they silenced me, but you got to realize that was a 2004 Colorado, and I'm still talking about it. So I don't shut up. You owed me the first punch, so I don't have to keep talking.
So roundabout, you guys have probably heard about Steve Wallace, a fellow Canuck. He has done some really interesting things inside vehicles for what he calls stealth camping. So stealth camping, for anybody that's wondering about the term, is basically you're camping when nobody knows you're camping. There's a gray area in there. Sometimes I think it's good, sometimes I think it might be a little unethical. It just depends how you're playing that game. But to each their own, no judgment. And yeah, I've seen some of his stuff. I've seen some really neat things be done in trucks and vehicles in general. Like just, I mean, I'm trying to think some of the stuff. I've seen people set up, like, I always call them the candy vans. You know, when you think of the white van with free candy written on the side, picture one of those without the free candy. And people turn those into some really neat, like, I'm going to say high class living areas. They have a bed, they got microwaves and TVs and desks. And I mean, they are spectacular. Some I've even seen with, like, I say running water, but I mean, it's at least a sink with a gray water catch and some sort of plumbing in it. They don't have a bathroom, of course, but I mean, and people live in these things. They have foregone their rent and this is their home. So, I mean, there is some really, really cool stuff you can do with any vehicle as long as you're willing to put the time in, do a little research. I mean, the sky's the limit.
I will say this 100% honestly, if I wasn't raising a young family, I think I would consider sort of like, maybe I buy some storage, or maybe I just sell off most of my stuff and try to live out of a vehicle. There's an appeal to it. It does. I do have an affiliation to that lifestyle. Like, I think it would be interesting, but I want to say a bit about stealth camp, because I find it's really interesting, because a lot of spots that would be awesome to camp in, the government kind of dissuades you not to, like, you know, just for example, just something that's kind of local to me and you, Victoria Park in Truro. Mm-hmm. I do not think they want people overnight camping there.
I don't think so either, no.
Right? But it's a beautiful spot. And if you're smart about it, in theory, and I'm not saying I have done it because I haven't. I'm not saying I wouldn't, but I have not done it. You could go and camp there overnight, and it wouldn't take much. And it takes a bit of skill. And all you're basically doing is proving that you can camp somewhere and have no one notice you. And that's kind of the ultimate leave no trace camping. Even when you're there, people don't notice you're there. And, you know, it is, along with the vehicle that you're talking about, it's making yourself nondescript, so no one really notice you. There's a concept I've heard referred to before as the gray man. And I think I may have spoken
about it. I was just thinking the same thing. You're like, that sounds like the gray man theory, but...
The gray man theory, and if anyone doesn't know what it is trying to make yourself as unnoticeable as possible. So you don't go into the woods dressed up in camo gear with tactical backpack and a big sleeping bag struck on the back, because people see that and they think, well, that guy's up to something. You want to go in and look like a guy who is, you know, maybe a college student who's just on the way to school or something, like, so nondescript that people see you and then they immediately forget about you. Like, you're not important enough to notice. So nothing about you stands out. You're at a completely average. And a gray man in Halifax might not be a gray man in Truro, may not be a gray man in Toronto. Like, everywhere it's going to change a little bit. But the thing is, what you kind of have to do is, what's the average person wearing for a jacket? What's the average pair of shoes? Like, you don't want to be anything that stands out. And if you can have your camping gear with you and look like that, look like you're just carrying a bag of groceries from the store, and then just sort of pop into the woods and set up and be there for the night and then come out looking like you just got back, you know, you're just out for a morning stroll. You've perfected the gray man theory. Like,
and some people do this really well. I've seen people set up camps in like highway medians. There'll be a little forested patch of road there, and they'll literally go in for the night, which is not, in certain parts, it's not illegal. There's no law against it. They weren't breaking any laws in this instance, but they went in, they had a fire, Dakota fire pit, small fire, of course, set up with a hammock, stayed the night, cooked some food, left in the morning, and honestly, I mean, I doubt anybody noticed this person was there.
Yeah, and it's kind of important, because if you do get noticed, even if everything's above and board and perfectly legal, the possibility that somebody sees you and then calls the cops because they're concerned that you might be up to no good. And, I mean, this is a problem that homeless people actually have to deal with, is even though they're doing absolutely nothing wrong, somebody notices them, calls the cops, and next thing a cop has to investigate. So now they're stopping there and they're asking you questions because they have a concerned citizen who wants to know what's on the go. And although the cops don't have to tell them anything, they do kind of want to be able to let them know, listen, like, this guy's not stalking you, he's not hurting anyone, he's perfectly fine. That kind of harassment just ruins your trip. Like, you do not want to have to go through that. People who sleep in vans inside of Walmart try to make it so that their vehicle doesn't stand out. Ideally, it's not a white van. You definitely don't put free candy on the side because that's attracting attention. There are people who do it in Priuses and do it very well in Priuses. Yeah. I actually watched a video of a girl. She lives in a Prius. She even has a system for her to get herself washed. Like, she can bathe or shower in a Prius.
I've seen some similar things. I don't think it was a Prius, but they made, you know, blackouts for their windows. And at night, you wouldn't even tell there was anybody in the car, honestly.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. You want it to be a vehicle that no one really notices, no one thinks about. You know, do I have a great gray man vehicle? No, I went and stuck a whole bunch of decals on it. Somebody sees me, they know I'm probably up to bushcrafting. I'm in the woods for a reason. But if you want it to be, you know, a gray man, it's a great theory. It's a great thing.
It's definitely interesting to look up. And it kind of could relate into overlanding, because Ben mentioned there are people that overland, and by definition they're overlanding, that just Walmart parking lot camp. They drive around, see a whole bunch of stuff, they stay in Walmart parking lots in very nondescript vehicles with very nice setups inside, but they just blend into society. People are like, oh, you know, it's just a vehicle park for the night, and they go on about their business, and there could be like three people in there watching TV, living their life to the fullest. You know what I mean?
Well, and the beauty of that, from my point of view, is because you're not attracting attention, you're also lowering your likelihood of somebody trying to steal, rob, break in, put your vehicle at risk. Because when it's something that stands out, it attracts attention, it makes people curious. Next thing you know, they think maybe there's something valuable, something I want in there. And next thing you know, you got a broken window, or you got, you know...
My biggest pet peeve on this, and you see it all the time, generally teenagers, early 20s, something like that, they'll have a $500 car with about $25,000 stereo in it, with Fusion speakers and Pioneer and all these, what I called steal me stickers, plastered over the thing. You know what I mean? The car is worth nothing, but you can guarantee somebody smashing that window out to see what kind of subs you got. They were going to pull your Fusion subs out of there and rip your Pioneer deck out of there and take your amp, because the car is nothing. It's what's inside it and what you plastered all over it that they're interested in.
Yeah. But,
Yeah, we kind of, went off topic a little bit. But anyway, that was basically our kind of talk on overlanding anyway. It was just a general discussion. Get the creative juices flowing for anybody that was kind of out there thinking about it, wondering about it. There is an article that Melissa had sent me that, who did I say it was? Motor Trend? Motor Trend done a good little intro article on this. And I will link it to the video. I'm not going to put it up because I don't know if that's a copyright breach or anything like that. But I do know I can link to it because I have seen it shared in other spots. I will include the link in the description. And it's a good general overview of overlanding. And like I said, it's something to think about. It's a legit way of getting out there, enjoying yourself, having some fun, playing with some gear, trying stuff. What do you think, Ben?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's something that we know I'm actively working towards. Do I have mine perfected? By no means. But I am excited about the fact that it opens up some new avenues and it gives me some new opportunities. And coming into winter months, it gives us a lot of advantages. Like, you know, it sounds stupid, but, you know, I can start the vehicle up and I got heat. I got heated seats. I got power. So it means I can camp in some pretty bad weather. And I have, you know, at any given time, one or two things sort of in the works to do with it, to add on to it. I have a hitch showing up in the next few weeks, maybe days, that I'm hoping to get put on. And that's going to increase my capability quite a bit. It's going to allow me to put, you know, a bike rack in the back or a mount for a spare tire and gas cans and all kinds of other things that you can do. Or just the cargo racks. I have a little aluminum cargo rack that I stick in the back of my van. I can now put that in the back of Subaru. Does that? That's going to kill my departure angle. But
in an instance, you could unpack that, take it off, do what you needed to do, and put it all back on.
Sure, I can. Definitely. But it also allows me to move that much more gear reasonably. So, you know, it helps. It definitely helps. It adds to the abilities and capabilities of my vehicle.
Sorry, go ahead, Ben.
No, that was kind of it.
I was just going to say one last comment here from Roundabout Media, who seems to be the one that's chatting with us tonight. I want to see you guys do a video of an overland camp together with Ben's Bushcraft Mobile.
Bushcraft Mobile.
It's not out of the realm of possibilities. I mean, we were just talking before coming on that the Phase 5, knock on wood, hopefully is coming up anytime now when it comes to COVID, which, providing that they do what they said they're going to, is going to unlock a lot or the last of the restrictions in there. So once that happens, we can get out. We can, you know, not that Ben and I can't meet face to face now, but that'll allow us to, you know, go off to Walmart and do stuff like that and not have to worry so much about that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I would love to do it because, you know, I'd love to get camping with you again. It's been a while. It's been too long.
Way too long.
And honestly, for me, this is just me personally, and I think this comes sort of down to a lot of the safety stuff we talk about, getting out there and enjoying yourself, but doing it safely. Having a second vehicle increases your safety so much more. If something happens and there's a second vehicle there, they can help get me out. You know, I can jump in with them and we can go back if somebody gets injured or whatever. Like, there's so many more things when you're just out there by yourself. And the beauty and the danger of these things is, you know, it allows, like I said, it took me about 45 minutes to get where I got. And I mean, I shared with you, Robert, where I went, but you know, it was back to, having someone else there would be a great relief, a great load off your mind, right? And you know, it'd be neat to see where we can go and what we can find. And there's some beautiful camping spots that I found. You know, I've been camping down by Cloud Lake Wilderness area. I can't even tell you what the name of this is. Panuk Lake.
Yep.
Yeah, it's spelled P-A-N-U-K-E, but I think they call it Panic. It is the local, let's call it. But there's a wilderness area down there, and it's big and beautiful. And it's wrote up all on the signs as you drive. It says this wilderness area. So, I mean, I know you can go down and camp and play there. So,
yeah, we'll definitely have to check it out. It's something that should be fairly achievable for us. So, yeah, that's not out of the realm of possibilities. And maybe we can do a video on that sometime in the future. But I think for tonight, we've killed our hour, much like we did. We've had our tangents, much like we do. Was there any closing remarks you want to end off with there, Ben?
Nah, I'm good. Same old, same old. You know, get out there, have fun, enjoy yourself. Let us know how it goes.
As Ben said, send us your stories. We love hearing from you. Night, everybody.
Night off.